Welcome to Control Intelligence, a control design podcast that goes deep inside the automation and technology that machine builders and system integrators rely on to keep machines humming. I'm Mike Bassador, Editor-in-Chief of Control Design, and in this episode, I'm rejoined once again by Dr. Brian Romano, Director of Technology Development at Arthur G. Russell Company and Executive Board Member of the International Society of Automation. Brian has been a frequent guest with me on Control Intelligence. He's an adjunct faculty member at both Central Connecticut State University and the University of Hartford, where he just celebrated his 8th year anniversary. Congratulations on that one.
Thank you.
He holds a PhD in technology and innovation and an MBA in business and data analytics. He is an International Society of Automation Fellow, and in June, he was elected as an executive board member of ISA. Congratulations on that as well.
Thanks again.
Once again, Dr. Romano, welcome back to Control Intelligence.
Thank you for having me again. It's always fun talking to you, Mike.
Fantastic. Well, today we're going to tackle a few more technical topics than we have in the past. I've assembled some questions that I doubt will stump you.
We'll see.
but certainly more challenging than the typical type of interview that we've done in the past. So let's jump into it.
Sounds good.
All right. Question one. How would you approach selecting a processing architecture for a custom-built controller versus using an off-the-shelf PLC for a high-speed assembly machine?
Great question. This goes back several years. This argument is kind of an ongoing debate that I've had with several of my colleagues. There was one machine early on, probably in the 80s or early 90s, when one of the guys that was working with me said, geez, I've got a servo controller, I got a PLC, I got a vision controller, I got a robot, all of which have the full power and capability to run this machine. Why do I need to have so many? Why can't I just use one? And he's right. Each one has a kind of a definite purpose. Each one has a reason why they're stronger in different areas. And it kind of comes down to application specific. Maybe I use this phrase often, the elegant solution, being able to understand why you've chosen or what you're choosing it for. So some of the questions you might ask is, does an off-the-shelf PLC have the power and abilities you might need to solve the problem without taking it to an extreme? What I mean by that is making it work, putting it into a corner where you're just barely scraping by and you've had to patch a bunch of holes to get it to work. Am I making one of these? Am I making 200 of these? If it's something that I can put on an ASIC or an embedded controller and get away with it and it's got plenty of power and it's low cost, more power to you. If it's something that you're going to be servicing a customer halfway around the world and they need to have low cost or available stock, spare parts, things like that, that kind of pushes your decision in one way or another. Is there a significant cost advantage of being able to do it one way or the other in terms of your system? Do you have a size restriction? If you're putting it inside of an enclosure, or maybe having a remote enclosure or something like that, are there things that you need to consider there? One of the big things today, especially with Industry 4.0, is there a communications mandate? Do you have Ethernet IP or Profinet or Profibus, things like that? Mm-hmm. I've done all these. I've had to make these questions or answer these questions and make these decisions, and it kind of comes down to application specific. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest things is, on top of that, is do I need to put a GUI or an HMI or some interface to it that may push you in a particular direction as well. Here at AGR, we're an Allen Bradley Gold level member. We usually start with Allen Bradley components, and only because, well, a couple of reasons. Number one, they integrate nicely, integrated motion, but they're also available worldwide. So for us, it's kind of a little bit of a, hey, your customers know what to expect. They know where to get the spare parts. That is part of the conversation. And it could be, it could be a different conversation tomorrow, depending on the project. Our division in North Carolina that we acquired 2 years ago, well, it was April, in this coming February, it'll be 2 years, but they're a little bit more accommodating to what the customer need. It might be Mitsubishi, Omron, whatever it is. It's again application specific. So don't know if I answered the question directly, but
Absolutely. Yeah.
it's a big, it depends.
Right. And great list of questions to ask. You kind of need a checklist like that, like, oh, we don't want to forget about the size limitation, or we don't want to forget, about the quantity. How many of these are we going to be producing?
Right.
Right. Yeah. All great things to have as a checklist when you're going into a project like that. What specific design considerations do you prioritize when mitigating EMI in a panel containing both high power AC drives and sensitive low voltage DC sensors?
Interesting. As I mentioned to you before we started talking here, I was up at a customer this morning. And we're looking at some machines that they have in their facility currently. And this is becoming more the norm than what I've seen in the past. Separate AC and DC enclosures. There's a couple of reasons why you might want to do that. One of which is noise. If I've got AC in a separate box and that box is a metalized box, I've got some shielding, things like that, all the noise is kind of contained in that one box. Where my DCIO, my sensors, things that are a little more susceptible are in a separate box. And you only connect what's necessary. We're seeing more and more from on our customer spec where they're telling us AC and DC are need to be in a separate enclosure. And part of that is arc flash concern. If they don't want their people troubleshooting their machine. Most of the time, when you're troubleshooting a machine, you're looking at IO. Hey, is sensor four on? Well, if I can open up a box and not have to don the bunny suit, as we call it, all the PPE for the arc flash, I can do my checking in low voltage. So if all my DC is in a separate box, I don't need any PPE. If the AC is in a separate box and I do need to troubleshoot, okay. Then I have to put the bunny suit on and go up and do my troubleshooting. So that's kind of it. The other thing is, and it's funny, we ship international. We ship to European Union and to England now that it's a separate entity outside of with Brexit. But there's the equivalent of a CE certification for England, and there's the still standard CE. The practices that CE kind of mandates you go through, they really pay attention to EMI. For instance, if you've got a servo cable on a coming off of a, coming from the field into your control box, you've got to cut a hole in the box. You've got to put a very specific grip mechanism that takes the cable. When you strip the cable, you got to strip the cable back and expose the braid on the shielded cable, and then you have to have within a certain amount of distance from the entrance, you have to have a grip that grabs the wire and grabs onto the braid. And it's all for noise immunity. That's its whole primary function. On top of some strain relief, it's more meant for the noise. All the time, no matter what you do, when you have a single box, you have AC and DC in a single box, let's say. The rule of thumb, going back to my electronics days, crossing at right angle. AC and DC need to cross at right angles to at least try to eliminate some of the potential noise. But yeah, again, it depends. Hate to keep saying that, but it does. But it comes down to what you're trying to do, how you're doing it, and if you have the ability to separate AC and DC, by all means, there's more than one reason why you might want to do that.
Are there a lot of applications where you've already seen AC and DC separated at this point?
It's funny, going back probably about 6, 7 years ago, we had one customer that was our first one that actually wanted a single box, like a 72 by 72 box with a welded septum, an arc flash barrier going up the center of the enclosure. AC was on the left side of the enclosure, AC was on the right side of the enclosure, and you had a plinth panel where you would pass any wiring, like the power for power supply or anything like that.
Right.
And it was all for arc flash suppression, being able to not be able to open up the door and do checks in the DC side without interrupting the AC side.
Right. Yeah. It's a good idea. I mean, arc flash is very deadly.
It is. We've all seen the videos.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Nothing to screw around with at all.
Nope.
Wow. And then, yeah. And a great point too, about the different international requirements, depending on where you are, whether it's in North America or Europe or parts of Europe or Asia, whatever the case might be. It's not always necessarily the same.
That is, yep, absolutely true.
All right. Next question. How would you design a secure edge to cloud pipeline that allows a machine builder to offer remote predictive maintenance? You know about that? Without compromising the end user's internal plant network.
Good one. This is sometimes harder than it might seem. Everybody's heard the whole IT-OT convergence and how IT people secure the internet and they secure the networks, but yet there's people on the OT side, the operational side, that need that connectivity to the outside world for being able to do data analytics. Hey, instead of having a machine go down for 8 hours, if I can call somebody up and virtually have them on our site in minutes, why would I not do that? Well, cybersecurity is the reason. You open up the door for convenience. You're also opening the door for potential bad clients. Without bringing up a drawing, which I could do, but if you looked at how we do our topology here, we've kind of adopted a scheme where it is in line with ISA 95 and also 62443, which allows you to have some level of cybersecurity, but also pays attention to the layers that ISA 95 talks about, the sensor layer, the control layer, the edge layer, all the way up to the cloud. So what we do is we have usually two managed switches in a machine, and one switch allows all the sensors and the PLCs to talk amongst themselves. And then there's another switch that allows that PLC, that concentrator, to talk to either other machines or to talk upstream to edge computers. So that way you have a managed switch that kind of takes care of itself, but then being able to send somewhat agnostic data up the next level. Every machine has that. If we need to communicate between machines, we can do that with what we call the private and public switches. The private is the one that lets the PLC talk to the sensors and the vision and things like that. The public switch lets the PLC talk to other PLCs and upstream. That takes care of level 0 and 1. Going up to the next level, we then put an edge computer in, and we'll typically put a package of software on that edge computer. We'll also put a database on that edge computer, and we'll run diagnostic packages or analytics packages like Aviva Edge, Sorba AI, potentially Ignition, that might end up a little lower as an HMI, but in that same realm. And once you have that, then you go through yet another switch, another firewall, and then finally up to the cloud. What we like to do is, if the customer allows, is come in right above the firewall and come in with the equivalent of an E1 or some VPN appliance to be able to provide remote support to the customer. That's in terms of what we can do to the customer. That's what we hand them. A lot of times they hand it back to us and say, yeah, no. and they don't a lot of times allow us to have access to the data, which only helps us help them. But sometimes we have to come in a different way to get access to that data. And a lot of times they'll give us a double deep VPN, where we have to VPN into a Citrix terminal and then jump over to a remote server. And then the server get spooled up with an instance of like Rockwell software or something like that, where we can then talk to the equipment on the floor. That we've have a couple of customers who have done that kind of typically. That's a slower methodology, but it is probably in terms of what they're looking for, and seeing that our customers are mostly medical device manufacturers, that is in their eyes the most secure way to do that. So if you ever want, I can share with you what that drawing looks like, but it is essentially the ISA layers with protection at pretty much every layer.
Sure. Yeah. If you want to send that over, we can include that when we publish this for everyone to listen to and watch and listen and see the diagram as well. That when you were speaking about the cybersecurity as well, it was reminding me of the attacks that occurred two, is it 2 weeks ago now on the water wastewater treatment plants, and just the when you're talking about the degrees, like some of those medical device manufacturers, the degree of security that they place on their networks and their controllers, and then you see some of those attacks. I mean, some municipalities don't have the resources of a medical device manufacturer to begin with, but still, something like a gateway or some sort of barrier between a PLC that you haven't changed the you haven't changed the blanket password on from the manufacturer in the first place, and then you're just exposing it to the internet. This doesn't seem like a good idea. I don't mean to make fun of, I mean, I'm sure lesson learned for those individuals. Now, gosh, I hope. But it's always interesting to see the level of security that any different entity might have based on the resources primarily, right?
You know, it's funny, Mike. One of the things I use LinkedIn for is networking and finding out what people are doing and how they're doing it, and then going down the rabbit hole of seeing, okay, let me go read the article that he read or whatever. There's several people out there saying, hey, you want to protect your PLC? Unplug it from the internet. I mean, just plain and simple. Just sometimes it's the only way to do it.
Right. Yeah. Well,
Depending on what hardware you have and things.
certainly. And I think we've talked before about 15, 20 years ago when remoting in was, it was a dial up on the phone to, okay, we're ready. Go ahead and open the firewall. All right, here we come. It was a very slow manual process. And then are we ready to close it? Yeah, it was nothing like today. COVID kind of allowed everyone to think, oh, we can just be remote and everything's fine, but there's still a lot of security that needs to be implemented for
You
sure.
know, it's funny. I don't want to go too far on this one, but I don't know if I mentioned it on one of our other broadcasts. But there was one of my customers that we had a job that we did in Oregon, and I was driving down the road. My technician was driving. I was in the passenger seat doing 70 miles an hour down the road. We had a problem with a machine that we had recently started up in their plant. When they called me, I opened up my laptop. The laptop had a cell phone card in it, a data card in it. Back then, VPN was secure enough, especially for what we were doing with this facility. They gave me VPN rights. I VPN'd in. I WAN'd over from their corporate office to their remote office in Oregon and pinged around. I knew because I had done the startup and we had seven plants that looked the same. Structure-wise, so I knew the structure. I pinged around and I found a switch where we were not seeing the stuff below the switch. Figured out what the issue was. Literally 3,000 miles away, driving down the road 70 miles an hour. I fixed the machine in less than 15 minutes with a
That's
bad switch. They had a
amazing.
bad network switch.
Yeah, that's amazing. Just the ability to be able to do something like that from that far away. 70 mile per hour on the road aside. Oh, and glad you weren't
I wasn't driving.
driving.
My wife would have yelled at me otherwise.
Yeah, great story though. All right, next question. How do you structure machine level SQL databases to handle high frequency time series data without impacting the real-time performance of the HMI?
Sometimes you can't. Every time I see this kind of question, I have to smile. That same customer that I was just talking about, it was my first opportunity to do a SQL interface to for data acquisition with this same customer. I had no clue what I was doing. I knew that I needed to store it to a database. I knew that there were packages out there that I could pull data and report on it, but to me, a database was a place to store it. I didn't know what a schema was. I didn't really know what SQL Transact was. So I built this database that looked more like a fat, flat Excel spreadsheet. It was ugly. And querying from it was pretty ugly too. Every time I would start a new table for a specific purpose on the data acquisition, it would be a new table and sometimes there were keys, like you're supposed to be, that linked the tables together. And it might have been the job number or the work order number. It might have been the time or the date. But the query at the end of the day across three or four tables was not pretty. So the first thing you need to do is understand schemas, understand what's considered today the third normal form, kind of the optimum. You can go first, second, third, fourth, fifth. Fifth, you get it to the point where it becomes too tight, too restrictive. Third normal form kind of ensures that you have the appropriate amount of keys and lack of redundancy built in. You don't want to have a table that has all the same information or multiple tables that have all the same information. You want to have a table that has just enough information with a key, then a table with just enough information and a key. And you keep doing that. And then when you link them via the keys. So when you go to do and pull the query back, you're looking at pretty small amounts of data at any one time. That's kind of getting there, though, is doing the schema up front, understanding your table structure, understanding how to set it up, understanding how to do that keying. And when I first went back for my MBA, sorry, my MS degree, that was one of the reasons I went back. I got this flat file. It doesn't work very well. Everybody is now starting to ask, how do you do SQL databases? How do you store data? I need to know how to do this better. Some of the commercial packages, like again, Aviva and things like that, and others, Wonderware, would put data nicely into a SQL database. Understanding how to structure it and get it out was kind of the important side. Once you figure out that schema and you start doing the work to do that reduction to the third normal form, it's kind of a key concept of getting it the unwanted dependencies within the tables. So with all that said, that's SQL. SQL's great for transactional data. And with some of the software packages that are out there that do, I guess what you would call store and forward, where you got the PC running the software and it's got OPC UA or some native communications that goes out and talks to the tags or to the information, pulls the information based on event triggers or things like that, grabs the information, and when it has the time, sends the transaction to the database. We've got some machines out there that are doing 60 parts a minute, where we're looking at everything like the recipe, the vial type, the vial size, the vial weight, the vial fill, the vision, number of pixels that we determine in the fill, the cap torque, whether it rejected, whether it was accepted, the print OCR, all of that per vial, 60 parts per minute going into a SQL database. Can be done. But if you're doing more time series data where you need high speed streams of real time data, you could look at influx databases as well. Another brand, another series, another type of database that is more aligned with the higher speed transactions. SQL's great for here comes a glut of data. Okay, next. Here comes a glut of data. Next. Don't get me wrong. Like I said, we were doing 60 a minute and successfully. But how do you structure it? First thing is understand your schema. Understand what the tables are. Reduce them to the third normal form. Look that up, everybody that's interested. And then link everything together appropriately with keys.
Great. Great advice. Excellent answer.
Thank you.
So how would you develop a virtual representation? That's what we used to call it, right? Of a machine that allows for PLC code validation before the hardware assembly is complete.
I have been to several conferences and trade shows and things like that where the epitome of this is you design it in SolidWorks or AutoCAD.
Right.
You write the code and you're doing that in an offline environment. You mush them together in software packages that will do the digital twin, as what we're talking about here.
Right.
And I can run the physics model with the code without even cutting a piece of metal or wiring. Boy, that's great when you say it fast. In our world of custom automation, where we do one, maybe two machines that are the same, we have an overlap. We do our mechanical design first. We do releases. We gather the information for each of the stations, what sensors are needed, what solenoids are needed, what servos. We gather all that information, pull it together. While we're doing that, mechanical engineering might be going down another road. So there's this slight offset or lag. And in order to keep the schedule, mechanical engineering has released it. Metal's being cut. They're starting to assemble while the control systems engineer is back here doing the BOM and trying to put together the control system package offset. While it would be, again, that elegant possibility of being able to do having the physics model and having the code pre-written, there's no reason why you can't do it after the fact. You have to do it anyway. So if you've got the physics model, you've got the drawing, you've got the design, you've got the ability to do configurations or motion in that physics package. I'm doing the code off on the side. And if I buy the package that allows me to tie the code to the physics model, that's an offline digital twin. Now I can actually start taking and running the machine, debugging the machine offline. More times than not, and maybe it's just specific to who we are and how we do work, that ends up being after the real machine. I wish it could be before, but a lot of times it's not. So what you can do, though, is now comes the next step in this digital twin evolution, especially for our customers and the end user. If they've asked for a digital twin as part of their deliverable, we give them that. And then we can take the IoT, the sensor data, the actual real world machine data, and pipe it to this in virtual environment. Now I really have a machine out on the floor doing something, reacting to real world IO. And oh, by the way, I've got this virtual machine that is using the same code and the same design. I can then take and stream the data over here. I've got two things running the very same infrastructure and the very same program. The big thing about that is while this thing's off on the left printing cache for me, if I hypothesize a change, I can make my change in the physics model or in the code or both, test it using the data coming from the real world. And then, oh, that works. Awesome. Now I can schedule the downtime on the real machine, make the changes that have already been, by the way, debugged, and then bring it back online quickly and with less downtime. So all of this is how you would develop that virtual representation. There's a couple of different types of digital twins. We might've touched on it in one of the other sessions, but this one here that I'm talking about is kind of the one where you would want to marry code and the physics model.
Right. So A quick follow-up question on that then. Which organization owns that digital twin? And that's not necessarily a standard answer, right?
Is not.
Because there are advantages and disadvantages, well, maybe not many disadvantages, but there are advantages for the machine builder to own it. There are advantages for the user, the plant, to own it. So is there typically one or the other? And well, what's your experience been?
The what it comes down to, I think, is if the customer requests it as part of their user requirement specification, we'd have to negotiate some way because, being blatantly honest, there are some proprietary things in our design, our feeder technology, our pick and place technology, and how we do
Ah.
it. Those are ours. And
Right.
while we can provide models, we don't necessarily provide some of the details of those things. So there's
Sure.
some IP that goes into part of this as well. So that's a great
Right.
question, Mike.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that, about the IP.
Yeah.
So typically not really one or the other.
Yeah. I mean, it's,
Varied.
yeah. I hate again, it depends.
Yeah, right. Fair enough. How might you use system modeling and simulation to perform a bottleneck analysis? Get understanding that you're the one with the digital twin, right? On a proposed machine layout before, oh, okay. So before any components are ordered. So this is again what you were talking about happening in real time, but before the components are even ordered or the machine is built.
Yeah, this is that other part of the digital twin. Being part of a couple of conferences, again, ISA last year, we had a session called The Many Faces of Digital Twin. There's the offline, there's the physics model. There
Right.
are packages called stochastic discrete event simulation. And those are the ones that might be more pertinent to this question that you're talking about here, where you take historical information. Mean time between failure, mean time to repair, speeds, bottleneck and known bottlenecks, how long it takes for things to occur speed wise, all of that data that you can pull from either equivalent or exact other machines would feed into this. Now, we've done this a couple of times. A couple of our customers have, we built a line for them. We'll call it line one. Several years later, they came back and said, we want a duplicate of that, but we want you to optimize it. So what we did is we went out, we've used Arena, FlexSim, and most recently I've used JameSim. They're all discrete event simulations. And we've acquired their information about how many, well, how long the conveyors are, what our proposed length of conveyor. We've asked them for that mean time to repair. Ask them for some of the normal statistics that go for production, OEE, uptime, downtime, things like that. And we feed that into the model. Then some of the things they want to ask us, the customer is asking us, how many racks or pallets do we need from between machines to optimize? We don't want to do too many because then we have a bottleneck, a backlog. We don't want too little because then we're going to starve our machines. And it takes longer to bring a machine back up and back down, acceleration and things like that, than keeping it running consistently. So in this case, what you would do is you would build the simulation, you would put the machines in the model, you would take the statistical data, put that in the model, and then you would vary the racks and pallets in the line and run it. You could run 2 years worth of data in 20 minutes, 5 minutes, depending on the
Right.
size of the machine. That's the whole point of these things. You could run years worth of simulations and get the information back, and it'll come back and say, after 2 years, having 100 pallets wasn't enough. Let's try 110, and you do it again. And you keep running it until you get that optimal flow, the highest OEE, the lowest downtime, things like that. We also had to do this for a similar tube line. A customer came to us and said, we know what we want this thing to look like. We've got a similar system in one of our plants. We'll give you the information. Can you model it and show us what it would look like? And we did. Some of these packages are a little more graphically intense, and they look more cartoonish, and they show you in more graphical detail what's going on. Some of the packages are more math oriented and blocky in their graphics, and the output is just as good, if not better, and they're faster. The graphics will tend to load down. Unless the PC is really highly capable, it will get bogged down a bit. So, depending on what you're looking for, if you want the graphics or if you just want the data, the discrete event simulation, depending on what you want, you select the one that's more appropriate. But we've used all three, and each has their strengths and weaknesses. One of them is open source and free. So if you want to download JameSim, I'll tell you which one it was. You can go online, it's a free download, and you can do everything that I've talked about with their online free discrete event simulation. And that's how the best way to do the bottleneck analysis.
Right. Yeah, great answer. As the one question I have, and I don't want to get us too far off track, but using open source systems or open source software, what kind of disadvantages are there to, I mean, is it a security problem, or is it just lack of support? Or, I mean, there is a community behind open source, right, that has support available, but what would a potential downside be?
You know, on this particular one, I'm not sure if I would say that their bug fixes come well, come quick, come easy. The guy who is the founder of the company, you'll see answering questions routinely. I can say that the power of the software, they do, let me back up a little bit. They do have a pro version that is a You do buy it and you get more
Okay.
functionality for it.
Sure.
So, apples for apples, you're probably talking about the pro version, but you can get a very high level of capability in the free version.
Sure.
Mike, I'm not sure in this particular case if I would say there if I if there would be a disadvantage. I don't know.
Right. Okay.
I haven't found one yet anyway.
Sure. Yeah, fair enough. I mean, there's a variety of open source systems available in for many things. Even like the Model Context Protocol is open source, which seems appropriate given the fact that it's kind of appeared to solve a problem that we didn't know existed until it was there all of a sudden, and now we're seeing native. Well, I don't know that we've seen a native MCP in any device yet, but there are ports listed there with which typically has some other protocol behind it, but they're coming.
They're coming.
I'm sure that
Yeah.
they'll be here, and
Go, going
that's
back, I'm sorry.
no, go ahead.
But going back to your question, the one thing I'd have to say is people like Arena and FlexSim, you can call 1-800 support and you'll get somebody.
Right.
You do have to go, like you had said, you do have to go to the community. You have to do a send an email to the support mechanism for the
Sure.
open source. So there is a difference. You get what you
Right.
pay for to some degree. This is kind of similar. When I did my dissertation, I needed a data mining software to be able to run through my data. And I had used in my MBA, one of the certificates I got as part of the MBA was a program called SAS eMiner. And it was a data mining software. Wow, did it have some power? It was cool, it was good, but it was also meant for companies that maybe stockbroking brokers or things like that, where you would mine a lot of data, discover a nuance, and save hundreds of thousands of dollars with that nuance. So the price of the package was based on that. I, as a student, there's no way I could do that. So I went to Google and I typed in free open source alternative to SASE miner. And sure enough, they're out there. They're open source and the same thing. It's there's no 1-800 support, but it worked a lot like the other one. You could do the same things. So there's some good things and bad things about going down that path.
Yeah, we'll have to put that on the list for next time. We'll
There
talk
you
more about open
go.
source. Okay. All right. I have a couple more questions for you here. How would you implement a deep learning model to improve reject or pass accuracy in an inspection system where lighting conditions are inconsistent? I'm feeling like this question is kind of like, remember the show Beat the Clock,
Yeah.
where they'd give you a task to do and then they would say, but you're wearing oven mitts,
Yeah.
right? So inconsistent lighting is are your oven mitts in this one?
Yeah, this is interesting. The technology, you touched on it a little while ago. AI is touching everything. A lot of the manufacturers, Keyence, Cognex, all of these guys, they have AI implementations in their vision systems. The way that it was, you had tool-based, rule-based vision systems. You would take an image, you would look for a transition between in the contrast between black and white. That would become, you'd find that level, you would mark it, you would do that multiple times, you'd measure. Those were rules. You had some tangibles. You knew what you kind of were looking at, and you could say, measure the distance between these and tell me how many pixels. Oh, by the way, it's 100 pixels per inch. And there you go. You could give me a distance now. Rule-based, a lot of things, blobs, things like that. They're out there, great. Then here comes AI, and AI is put into cameras in a different way. The first time we were introduced to it, what we had to do is have a camera and a PC, and the PC had to have a GPU in it. And you had to feed all of the images that you wanted to train into the PC. The PC would run and train the model because that's where the horsepower was in the GPU. And then once the model was formulated, you transferred the model to the camera, and the camera ran the model. It didn't need the full power of the GPU. Here comes more memory, more horsepower in the processors. Now I can do most of that in the processor. I can do the training. It still sometimes gets out of hand and you run out of horsepower in the processor in the camera, but you can now just train, bring 20 good images and 20 bad images and say go. And that'll accommodate for the inconsistent lighting that you were talking about. Hey, this is about what it looks like when it's good. This is about what it looks like when it's bad. All right, I know my extremes, and now I can look at the differences in between them. I just have to have known good ones, known bad ones. Some of the new cameras that we've seen have taken the concept of the GPU and sort of brought it back, but now the GPU is in the cloud. And as long as you have connectivity to the cloud, you can set your model up, you can do all the training you want, no limitations now, and then take the model and bring the model back down to the camera. And now again, the horsepower is just in the camera enough to run the model, not necessarily do the training. All right, so now you have rule-based and AI-based. There is a little bit of a happy medium starting to pop up a little bit where that AI functionality of inspections tell me if it's good or if it's bad. Not necessarily tell me that it's 1 inch. It just tell me if it's good or it's bad based on what I trained it. Now they're starting to merge the worlds together, and you're starting to get some of the rules base overlapping with the AI. So you're going to be able to accommodate perhaps that inconsistent lighting condition or varying products within the realm as long as you have a good training model.
So what do you mean by marrying the two? I mean, how does Is
Right
it
now it's
still AI based when you're marrying the two?
yeah, there is some AI element built into it. It is not just rules based and it's not just AI based. You have a little bit of a combination of both, and the tools can interact.
Last question. How do you balance the use of newer technologies, for example, 5G or AI, against industrial demands for long-term equipment reliability and spare part availability?
Yeah, this is a tough one. Some of the technology already and capabilities exist. It's clean, it's there, but sometimes the information is difficult to come up with. Yeah, reliability and spare part availability. So being able to look at what is out there in terms of new technology. I guess one of the presentations I had done early on is technology is usually the knee-jerk reaction. Hey, look at what it is. Let's throw that out there. I saw it in a magazine last week. And a lot of times it's putting the cart before the horse because it's not necessarily the technology that is the end all be all. It's understanding what you're trying to solve, what the problem is you're trying to solve.
Absolutely.
So being able to look at it from that aspect. In one of our previous sessions, I had talked about a, if you've ever read the marketing book Crossing the Chasm, that was based on a theory of diffusion of innovation by a PhD, Dr. Everett Rogers. And he's the one that came up with the innovators, the early adopters, the late adopters, and the laggards, kind of giving a category of where technology is adopted. And you can't it can't be adopted until it's been diffused. If the Apple iPhone was never widely used, it wouldn't have been adopted. So you think about that in terms of technology. How do you balance these new technologies? And do you wait until it's proven? Is there enough of a call to say, you know what? I've got to solve the problem. They're telling me they can. Do I take the early jump and get ahead of the crowd and try to do it? Or do I wait a little bit and see what the others are doing? So there's a little bit of a happy medium in there. In terms of Industry 4.0, things that we've talked about before, it's my opinion that we're clawing our way out of the chasm right now. It's not quite there. There's a lot of information, a lot of technology that's being applied to the factory floor, to the plants, and how that information is being used is part of the overall issue. And what I mean by that is, I still have 1980s and 1990s pieces of equipment out there running, printing cash. How do I bring that into today's technology to get more information out of it? How do I leverage that? So there's old stuff still working, there's new stuff that has the ability. How do I take these newer technologies and bring them forward? Part of what we're talking about here, you had mentioned spare part availability. If we leverage what we've been talking about and say we adopt the digital transformation and we're able to do predictive analytics and predictive maintenance, I now have the ability to tell when my machine might be going down ahead of when it really goes down. I don't necessarily need to have the spare parts on the shelf. Because this thing, if I'm trusting it as I should, it will tell me based on historical data and what I'm seeing currently that, hey, I've got 2 weeks before I have a potential downtime event. Go order the equipment, go order the spares, bring the machine down gracefully, make the change, bring it back online. And now you've just shortened your downtime. You don't have spare parts on your shelf, let's say, so you don't have a lot of inventory costs. But you're still able to maintain your business. So with all that said, I'm a self-admitted geek and nerd when it comes to technology. I abide by the mantra, he who dies with the most toys wins. You should see my garage. So there's always a good balance of using newer technology and trying to leverage that versus the tried and true things.
Sure. Well, and as you were saying that, it was reminding me, it was more than 10 years ago, but probably closer to 15, when Harding introduced that device, which won the Hermes Award at Hanover Messe for tapping into dumb devices and being able to pull data out of them for the purpose of Industry 4.0, essentially.
Yep.
Turning a dumb device into a smart device just by being able to access the data. And there have been quite a few other companies that have come up with similar solutions since then. But that technology has been around a while now. And the thing that is most interesting, I think, is so many of these components or devices or even systems have been in place for so many years. You know, there's an installed base of PLCs or SCADA systems that have been around for decades.
Sure.
Have outlived the original engineers that not only developed them, but implemented them. And now engineers have inherited them. And Honeywell is a great example where they had to bring back support for an old system because people still had it. And even though they were trying to migrate those people were those users were having none of it. They were content with their system. And finally, Honeywell decided, okay, we're going to continue to support it after all, just because it's in place.
Yep.
And there's a lot of hardware that's out there that finding that those spare parts for it really become like, do you go on, is eBay even still a thing? I don't even know.
Yeah. It's still there.
Is it still, okay. I didn't know, to be honest with you, but that was, you know, for the longest time, like obsolete parts, like that was where you had to find them. Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny. The question is, how do I balance new technology to maintain have reliability? That is sort of the whole premise of the whole Industry 4.0 movement. And as I talked about, you have that crossing the chasm thing. And we've been in Industry 4.0 since 2011 when it was first
Right.
coined. So
yep.
15 years ago, we've been trying to do this. And it really hasn't, unfortunately, because of the install base, because of the data needs, because of the database, because of the workforce shortage and the skills gap. There's people are doing, trying to do more with less people. So you really need to kind of grab the digital stuff and run with it if you are trying to maintain your company with fewer people. But this whole thing is it trying to find that happy medium of I got old stuff, I got new stuff. I need to extract the data. I need to understand the data. I need to put the proper amount of hardware in there. I need to put the right data acquisitions, as you said, that's been around forever, but now the analytics side of it to drag the information out and use it to our advantage. That's kind of the biggest part of it.
Absolutely. Great insights, as always, Dr. Romano.
Thank you. Thank you
thanks
very
for
much.
Thanks for joining me once again. Always an inspiring conversation, and I learned a lot today, as I always do.
Yeah, me too.
Yes. Well, thanks to our listeners as well for joining us on this episode of Control Intelligence. If you've enjoyed this episode, I can't see how you couldn't, of Control Intelligence and Endeavor B2B podcast, don't miss our older episodes and subscribe to find new podcasts in the future. You can find our podcast library at controldesign.com, or you can download all episodes on Podbean or via Apple Podcasts or Google Play. Thanks once again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.